This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. If it's not hot where you are, consider yourself fortunate. The world has been dealing with triple-digit temperatures, Fahrenheit, shall we say 40 degrees Celsius and plus, all summer. 9 record highs have been broken, and it's especially dangerous in urban landscapes and among vulnerable populations, like children, pregnant women, and the elderly. What is behind this heat, and how can you stay safe? Joining us from Atlanta is Chris Bruin, a meteorologist with the Weather Channel. Chris, welcome to 1A.
Hey, thank you so much for having me, Joshua.
And joining us online from Japan is Motoko Rich, the Tokyo Bureau Chief for the New York Times. Motoko, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Definitely want to talk to you about some of the heat records that have been broken in Japan and the impacts there, but we also want to hear from you, wherever you are, about the heat that you are encountering. What have the impacts been? How are you dealing with it? And what questions do you have about this global heat wave? Email us, 1A@WAMU.org. Comment on our Facebook page or tweet us at 1A. Chris Bruin, give us a sense of where the heat in the U.S. is the worst. I know there are some places like, say, Palm Springs, California, where the heat went up to like 119 degrees this week. I guess they're kind of used to that kind of heat, but are we mostly talking about places where it often gets super hot, or is it getting hot in places that are not used to it?
Well, there's a mixture of both, certainly. And areas that are typically hot are also hotter than they typically see. So I think there's a lot to it than just areas in the desert, which people think of as being hot. But when you're talking record-breaking highs in a place like Death Valley, by the way, Death Valley, California, the hottest spot in the world, breaking a record high yesterday, they hit 127 degrees. The old record was 126. And when you're talking areas that are really hot, that are breaking records, it is a big deal. It's not just areas that are hot either. It's areas in the Northwest. We're going to really focus on them over the coming days. You're going to see a lot of this heat get worse, especially across the West. Now, the East Coast, pretty quiet and wet, so that'll keep things cooler. But in the Northwest, I think that's really where the worst of the heat will be. And it's all relative. We're not going to see 100-degree temperatures in a place like Seattle, but keep in mind, Seattle is going to see temperatures well into the 80s and 90s, and Seattle is the least air-conditioned city in the U.S. So there's a lot of factors that play into it. Places that are typically cool this time of the year, or typically, you know, you don't need air conditioning, they're going to be seeing temperatures in the 90s. So it's going to be very uncomfortable, and it can turn deadly if not taken seriously. And it's also getting hot where it doesn't cool off enough at night, so you don't get a lot of relief even after the sun goes down. We've seen that in Texas, where overnight lows have been in the 80s consecutively, and they've just been seeing the worst. I think Texas has really been the worst, and that will start to let up over the coming days, mm-hmm. and then that core of heat's really going to build in across the desert Southwest into California, and then right up the West Coast into the Pacific Northwest.
Motoko Rich, tell us about what's going on in and around Tokyo. I understand the conditions and temperatures there have kind of caught people off guard in a way, so much so that kind of culturally, people are having to adapt to the way they deal with this kind of heat. What's it been like where you are?
So you're right. It's definitely taken people off guard, and even the Japan Meteorological Agency described the heat this year as unprecedented. And this is a place that's used to the heat. I mean, it gets pretty hot in the summer in Tokyo, and it's steamy as well, very humid. But this year has just been super, super hot. In fact, there was a record that was set on Monday, 106 degrees in a city outside of Tokyo. So we've got the usual things, people going to the pool, cranking up the air conditioning. But this is a country where people often are quite stoic. Air conditioning rates are not nearly as high as they are in the United States. People often wear kind of fairly heavy outfits. You know, a lot of people still wearing suits to work, full on suits to work, and that kind of thing. So there's had to be some adaptation and moderation. And yet, I was out and about on the streets today and talking to people who were sort of saying, you know, there's nothing we could do. We have to put up with it. I have to wear a suit to meet clients. All I can do is hope that maybe the client will urge me to take off my tie at the meeting. Also went to the Olympic Stadium that's being built for the 2020 Tokyo Olympics. And there's a lot of concern here already about how athletes and fans will cope with this kind of heat during the summer of 2020. But at the stadium, the construction workers, there are about 2,000 workers on site working through this heat. And most of them are wearing these pretty cool jackets. I mean, when you see them, just a casual observer, you think, my God, that person looks like they're going to a ski lift. But they actually have little battery-operated fans in the pocket, so that sort of keeps them cool. And then, you know, the usual things, you wet a towel, put it around your neck, stuff your helmet with some kind of pad that keeps you cool. But people who were used to kind of putting up with things or trying to conserve energy, for example, I ran into a family today that were telling me that usually they turn the air conditioning off at night, but it's so hot that they've had to keep it on all night. But in order to conserve some money on their electricity bills, family of four packing into one bedroom every night, so they only have to air condition one room.
We are speaking to Motoko Rich, the Tokyo bureau chief for the New York Times, and Chris Bruin, a meteorologist for the Weather Channel. Amanda wrote on our Facebook page, I've been living in Phoenix for the past 14 years, and you see the difference in the temperatures and weather every year. How climate change is still a hoax for some is beyond me. We'll be talking more about Phoenix and about our changing climate as our conversation goes on. And we want to hear from you, too, what you're dealing with related to the heat. 1A@WAMU.org. Chris Bruin, let's talk about some of the big effects of this heat. I guess the one that stands out the most to me is Yosemite National Park. Big sections of the park are closing at midday today. You know, Cal Fire is fighting a major wildfire out there. We heard more about wildfires in the Mountain West states, including parts of Colorado when this program was visiting there recently. Is fire activity kind of the big heat-related, you know, environmental threat this year, and how much are we seeing?
Certainly, and you really see this tie in to where we've seen some of the hottest temperatures across the U.S. And if you look at the active wildfires right now, we've got 84 active wildfires burning close to 750,000 acres. So we're talking 768,000 roughly actively burning. Those are active fires, not what we've seen in the last year. So year to date, we're at 3.3 million acres, which is still a million acres less than last year. But keep in mind, we're only in July and we still have a lot of wildfire season to go. We're just heading into wildfire season, especially across the West. This is typical for this time of year. But I think this year certainly is going to be one of the higher years, given how quickly the wildfires have started. And a lot of it has to do with the heat. I want to go back to July 6th when we saw not only record-breaking heat in California, but we're talking all-time record highs, and it correlated perfectly with how many wildfires we saw. I mean, it was a day during the week. It was a Friday back in the early part of July, and California was breaking record highs before lunchtime, and not only that, Ramona, California hit their all-time record high before noon. So it's a big deal when we're talking all-time record highs. I think we live in a day and age where record highs are pretty common. Everyone experiences them, and they're not that big of an issue anymore.
Right.
But when you're talking all-time record highs being broken, these are temperatures that have never been seen before. And we saw this in many locations, especially across the L.A. Basin and also down into San Diego. And during that time, especially by about lunchtime, was when we saw a lot of wildfires pop up within the vicinity of a lot of those metro areas.
Yeah, and by
several
I should note, by the way, Ramona, California is down near San Diego. It's kind of like north, northeast of San Diego.
Yes. And we had huge wildfires spark up. And when it's so hot outside, it dries the air more quickly, and it pulls out that moisture. So not only are you dealing with a lack of moisture in the air, you're also drying up the ground. So the soil moistures are running well below average as well. And drought plays into a big part of it. It's been exceptionally dry across the Four Corners, and that's where we've seen a lot of the wildfires. But back to the wildfire that's pretty much has grabbed the nation's attention right now. It's the Ferguson fire there near Yosemite. It's only 26% contained, and this fire has certainly grown rapidly to about 37,000 acres and larger. It's the largest fire the park has dealt with in years, and they actually haven't closed the park in decades. In fact, the last time they closed the Yosemite Valley, which is the main part of Yosemite National Park, was back in 1990 when they were dealing with the Arock fire. That was the largest in Yosemite history. Now, will this one get that big? It's certainly a possibility. Right now, it doesn't look to be that way, but smoke certainly the factor. And even if the park isn't, the parts of the park that are not closed, they're dealing with smoke so thick you can't even see the beauty of the park.
I know our time with you is short, Motoko and Chris, but I wonder what Japan is going to do going forward with this heat. I understand there have been a number of fatalities. There have also been some deadly floods that hit the northern part of Japan this month. What's the plan going forward?
Well, I think at the moment the government has been talking about a lot of things, but there's no concrete plan. I mean, there is a recognition, though, that this is only going to get worse with regards to the flooding. I think there's been discussion about building up embankments and dams and such to try to guard against the damage that was caused by the floods in western Japan earlier this month, when over 220 people died due to the heat wave. They've seen officially so far 86 deaths from heat stroke. But those numbers are likely to go far, far higher. I mean, this is an aging population. So when you talk about vulnerable population, Japan has a lot of people over 65, and about half of the 23,000 people who were hospitalized just last week for heat-related illnesses were over 65. So I think there's going to have to be a lot of education campaigns, making sure to install air conditioners in every possible place that might not currently have one. On the flip side, from the elderly population, there are students who play sports during the summer, and there have to be some accommodations for not making people do heavy runs outside, maybe right, adjusting the times of games, and so on and so forth.
Motoko Rich, the Tokyo Bureau Chief for The New York Times. Motoko, thanks for talking to us.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
And Chris Bruin, meteorologist with The Weather Channel. Thanks, Chris.
Hey, thank you. Appreciate it much.
Glad to hear from quite a few of you who are sharing your stories from across the country and around the world. Lawrence tweeted, lived in Orlando almost a half century, and while we're always hot this time of year, it's the intensity of our storms that's striking. We'll get to more of your stories about the heat and what's being done to help us endure the heat in just a moment. I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We are talking about the heat around the world and across the country and what's being done to help us deal with the heat and stay cool. Susan wrote on our Facebook page, my friends in Scandinavia are sending me photos of themselves sweating. It's been almost 90 in Finland and Denmark. This is sweltering for them. Mario is in Birmingham, Alabama. Mario writes, the heat here is something we're used to, but the humidity is making it unbearable. The current temperature is 78 degrees, but it's projected to be in the upper 90s every day. We are just finding any way we can to stay cool. Susan tweeted, not gloating? It's perfect here in Cincinnati. Our heat wave was a few weeks ago, 12 days over 90, high of 85 today, low of 64 tonight. You kind of are gloating, Susan, but that's okay. I totally understand. I bet a lot of people would love to trade places with you, especially in parts of the world where it is super hot. And that's what we want to talk about with our next two guests, what this heat means for our environment and what this heat means for our health. We also welcome more of your questions and thoughts as well. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A or email 1A@WAMU.org. Joining us from KGNU in Boulder, Colorado is Dr. Joining us in studio is Dr. Georges Benjamin, emergency physician and the executive director of the American Public Health Association. Dr. Benjamin, welcome to 1A.
Glad to be here.
Almost called you out of your name. I am very, very sorry about that. At least 70 people have died after heatwave conditions swept through Quebec and Canada. We heard about scores of people who have died in Japan. Who is most likely to be affected by this extreme heat? Is it mostly the very young and the very old, or are there other populations to watch out for too?
Yeah, we focus a lot on the very young and the very old, but there's a population of folks who are at high risk. So people with disabilities, people who are on chronic medications, particularly people who are on mental health medications, for example, people who are on cardiovascular medications. All these medications have the perspective that they don't allow your body to really sweat correctly. And people with disabilities who just can't get out of a hot environment.
Who maybe need assistance to move around, get upstairs, get to an air-conditioned area.
Exactly. Grandma, grandpa, or the little lady or little man down the street, or the kid who's in a wheelchair who just can't get around.
We've heard from several of you who are dealing with other issues that are exacerbated by the heat. Here's what one listener submitted through our app, 1A Vox Pop.
This heat just keeps affecting my asthma, and it makes it harder for me to breathe the longer I stay outside, so I don't go outside if I can help it.
Thanks to Meg from Dorset, who commented on our app 1A Vox Pop. And so, Dr. Benjamin, it sounds like there's not just the heat, which causes its own problems, but then other medical problems that can be exacerbated by it. And for some folks, I imagine this is kind of the very worst time of year to be around.
Well, it is. And you think the cold red days, that where the weather and the pollution is just terrible. And while we've made great strides in pollution, this weather certainly makes it worse.
How common are heat-related deaths, even among vulnerable populations?
No, they're pretty common. And when you think about people, particularly that live in urban settings, just because of all the concrete and the black tops, they create something called the heat island effect. Certainly when you're in an urban setting, you're much more vulnerable. But I think the real issue here is the people that are in places where it wasn't really hot before, who aren't used to this and really don't know what to do when the weather gets this hot. They are really going to be at risk.
I was just thinking about that with the tweet we got from Lawrence, who lives in Orlando, and mentioned the intensity of the storms that's striking. I'm a Florida native, so I am used to seeing these summertime big boomer thunderstorms that, like, nothing is scarier than being at Disney World when lightning is echoing through the park. It is incredibly terrifying. Yeah. But it also kind of occurs to me that with all those people on vacation over the summer, you know, they may get to Orlando and feel like, oh, this is fine. I can walk around the whole park all day. And it seems like people on vacation are in some ways maybe even more susceptible because they're not used to the weather where they are.
You're right. You know, we used to see this when I was in the Army. We bring these young folks from relatively moderate level climates and bring them to the south or where it was really hot. And they weren't used to the heat. And so they weren't pacing themselves. They frankly weren't drinking enough water. They weren't keeping well hydrated. And they weren't attuned to the signs and symptoms of heat-related injury.
Now, define enough. Everybody seems to have a different definition for how much water is enough. Do I need one glass of water? Do I need 24 ounces of water? Do I need to just bring a gallon jug with me and drink all day long? Like, how much is enough? And is there too much?
Well, for the normal human, there's no such thing as too much, although there are clinical conditions where you can get that. Just park that aside. But certainly drinking, you know, a gallon every couple hours is pretty good in a really, really hot day. And you really just can't drink enough. If you think you're thirsty, drink it.
If you think you're thirsty, just drink more water.
Yeah.
Okay. We are speaking to Dr. Georges Benjamin, Executive Director of the American Public Health Association. J.S. Frank tweeted, I live in Tucson, where heat is expected, but not like this heat wave. One of our problems is keeping people who are homeless safe. There are cooling stations, but not everyone can get to them. I have frozen bottles of water in the car to help hydrate people who need it. Justin emailed, I'm a park ranger for a national park in the Four Corners region. And this year we've had an almost 50% increase in heat-related medical issues and rescues compared to this time last year. Dr. Benjamin, talk about the effort that kind of ramps up leading up to the summer. You got people like Justin who deal with the public on a regular basis, good Samaritans like J.S. Frank who are just trying to kind of be ready. Are public health agencies in the habit of kind of gearing up for summer, saying, okay, this is what the forecast looks like, here's where we're vulnerable, here's how we need to get ready? Like, how does that work?
Yeah, most of the public health agencies, from the locals to the federal agencies, like the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, begin to put out information to the public about, yep, it's getting hot, and start getting prepared, particularly around the July 4th holiday, as people beginning to do the first barbecues. And then just putting out lots of public alerts, letting people know when the air is not of the highest quality. Anytime we know that there's going to be a heat wave over 3-4 days, letting people know that that's a really high risk period. Somewhere's after, you know, usually a hot day one day is not such a big deal, unless you have a underlying bad medical condition. But when it starts getting the bird 3 or day 4, we need to start telling people that start looking out after your neighbors. Don't go outside. Telling people how to dress so you dress more loosely. Again, reminding people drink lots and lots of water or other sports drinks and avoid alcohol and tea and other things that make you lose water, like diuretics.
Tea makes you lose water?
Yeah, tea is a diuretic, anything with caffeine in it. So,
And what is a diuretic?
Oh, a diuretic is a substance that makes you urinate and you lose water. So they're water pills that some people take for their high blood pressure in particular. People who have underlying medical condition like diabetes, if their blood sugar's out of control, you can also lose a lot of water as you spill sugar.
So things like
diabetes.
So things like alcohol, caffeine draw water out of your system, but
that's
you
correct.
Need the water when it's hot.
They help you get they dehydrate you.
I know there are some folks who are trying to stay inside as best they can, but you know, not everybody's got AC like we have here in the Northeast and the Southeast where I'm from. Ivan is in South St. Paul in Minnesota. Here is what he sent us.
I live on the top floor in a west-facing apartment in a 100-year-old building with functionally no insulation or forced air heating cooling. Because of the geography, I get very little natural airflow, and this year I finally broke down and bought an air conditioner. Not only is the cost of the unit taking a bite out of my budget, I now have to pay for installation fees, storage fees, and running it just a few degrees above the ambient temperature has doubled my summertime electric bill.
Ivan, thanks for contacting us and sharing your story. I imagine, Dr. Benjamin, that this changing climate cycle is leaving a lot of people kind of shocked at the change and also at an increased risk. Folks like Ivan, who never needed air conditioning before, and now suddenly they find themselves drenched in sweat.
Oh, that's absolutely right. And I think the take-home message is that climate change is here and it's affecting our health today. And that means we all have to do various things to both personally adapt to this, and our government agencies need to help us adapt by putting in cooling centers and, again, notifying the public and doing things to make sure people are aware what the risks are on each and every day.
Gail wrote on our Facebook page, whether people believe in man-made climate change or not, certainly we can all agree that reducing pollution to our air and the environment is a good thing. Indeed, Gail. And let's talk more about the environment now. Joining us from KGNU in Boulder, Colorado, is Dr. Martin Herling. He's a research meteorologist from NOAA's Earth System Research Lab. Dr. Herling, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Can we just settle the climate change question? Is this climate change we're looking at, or is it something else?
Well, let's talk about that. The previous guest had mentioned global heat wave. They mentioned that 2018 summer has been unprecedented. It was stated that there are numerous all-time heat records. All of these are symptoms of a planet that is warming, and warming at a rate that is unprecedented. Data from various sources, from the UK, from the US, from NASA, from NOAA, all indicate that each decade, especially since 1990, has been warmer than the previous decade. The rate of warming is unprecedented for the planet as a whole. It's about 0.2 degrees Celsius per decade. We've warmed about 0.6 degrees Celsius for the planet just in the last 30 years. That's about a degree Fahrenheit. Now, you might say, well, that doesn't explain how uncomfortable it's been recently. And, of course, there are weather events that make heat more extreme from day to day and from one location to another. But climate change expresses itself in a rather clear and definable way. The oceans warm quite a bit less than the land. The oceans are most of the global surface coverage. Land warms twice as much as the oceans. So ocean temperatures have risen maybe a half degree Celsius, the land temperature twice that much. And then the higher latitudes part of the land warm again twice as much. We've seen some incredible heat in the Scandinavian countries, in Alaska, in Canada this summer. All of these are the symptoms that I would say we would expect from climate change due to increase in greenhouse gases, and in fact were predicted in the first international government panel on climate change report in 1990.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Yeah, Dr. Herling, I was just going to ask you about that, whether or not the heating of the planet we're seeing now, which we can say is climate change, whether that heating is in line with what climate scientists have forecast. As I understand it, the earlier forecasts were not perfect, but they were pretty close, weren't they?
They really were. And, you know, the purpose of meteorology, I'm a meteorologist, the purpose of meteorology is to make predictions. And the purpose of the science and the work that we do in our science, in NOAA and other agencies that do this work, is to improve those predictions. The predictions really speak to the strength of our theories of understanding the way weather and weather patterns and climate vary and change. Here's just an excerpt from the 1990 report, which at the time was the first launch of this international effort to collect the scientists. There were about 170 scientists. 25 countries were represented. Now it's much larger in the effort. And here's what they said. They made the following predictions. Under the assumption in 1990 that greenhouse gas emissions would continue to increase at a business-as-usual rate, is what they called it then. They foresaw that the temperature of the planet would increase at the rate of 0.3 of a degree per decade, with a range of uncertainty between 0.2 and 0.5 degrees C. And they said that by 2025, we're close to that, the planet would have warmed about 1 degree C above 1990 levels. We are very close to those numbers, and that provides the strongest evidence, not only that climate change is the factor causing this global heat wave, but that the science had foreseen it from the theories that speak to the magnitude. And I think this has been one of the questions. Well, in fact, I think I heard the word used, changing climate cycles. This is not a cycle we're dealing with for the planet as a whole. It's a trend. And a trend is something that is expected to continue so long as we continue to inject additional greenhouse gases into the atmosphere.
Dr. Herling, it seems like Europe is bearing the brunt of the heat, at least right now. And the west coast of the U.S., California and so forth, are dealing with the worst of the heat in the U.S. at the moment. Why is the heat wave kind of distributed where it is? Why Europe? Why the west coast and not the east coast?
Now, this is a great question. Of course, in any given summer, there'll be patterns in this. There'll be areas of high pressure that are locked into a particular location just for that summer, for a couple of weeks in that summer. So there's always these weather patterns superimposed on trends. But it's an interesting question you raise, because it's also a science challenge that we have in looking at the trend pattern of surface temperature in summer. Europe, since about 1970s, in fact, you go back to 1900 from data sets that are pretty reliable, has borne the brunt of the warming trend to date, as has the Western United States. Somewhat absent from this warming trend has been the central part of the United States, a pattern we call the warming hole pattern. The science does not yet know why this small part of the world, which happens to be in the grain belt part of the United States, has not participated anywhere close to the rate of warming as Europe has, or as the far western U.S. has.
So it's unclear exactly why it is that some places have it worse than others.
It is unclear. And, you know, it's interesting. The Dust Bowl stands out as an iconic event in the climate variability of the United States. The 1930s in quite a few places continue to rank as the hottest year, 1934, or the hottest decade, hottest individual days. The Dust Bowl was special. But even if you begin your trend analysis of temperature well after the Dust Bowl, there still is a certain absence of warming in summer temperatures over that region. And that's an interesting science question. That's why I continue to stay employed as a researcher to sort that particular question out.
Gatto tweets, contractor with asthma here. DC's bad air and hot weather make working outside hard, even for a little bit. When I have to go into a hot attic, it's straight dangerous. Dr. Benjamin, give us a sense of what we should be looking out for in ourselves. What symptoms, what signs, what indicators we should look out for as a warning that maybe I should back off. Maybe this is the heat's becoming dangerous.
Yes. Let's talk about four steps. First one, of course, your skin. Obviously, we all know what's, you know, sunburn. Many of us experience sunburn or just some rashes from the heat. Then muscle cramps. You're out there, you're working, and all of a sudden your muscles, your legs, your arms cramp up. Those are very commonly heat cramps, and you need to stop and get out of the heat and drink lots of fluids. And then heat exhaustion. You know, that's a combination. You're out, you're working, you just feel bad. But commonly they faint. People faint. That's heat exhaustion. And we want people to then move into a cool place, so you loosen your clothes, wet down. And if it gets really, really sick, you get vomiting or your illness, you just really, really feel bad. You need to seek medical attention. And then the really bad one, heat stroke. And that's where you have neurological changes and temperatures are over 103 degrees. And that is a medical emergency.
So checking your skin, cramping, exhaustion, fainting, or a sense of malaise, vomiting, or stroke. Definitely warning signs to keep an eye out for. We'll continue this conversation in a moment with Dr. Georges Benjamin of the American Public Health Association and Dr. Martin Herling of NOAA's Earth System Research Lab. We've talked a lot about Phoenix so far, the extreme of the extremes, 100 days per year over 100 degrees. If any city needs to cool off, it's Phoenix. We'll tell you what they're doing to make that happen in a moment. Stay close. Back now to our conversation with Dr. Georges Benjamin of the American Public Health Association and Dr. Martin Herling of NOAA's Earth System Research Lab. Glad to get some more of your stories about what you're dealing with in this super hot summer. Hope tweeted, I am living at my college this summer, which doesn't have air conditioning. I have to keep 3 fans on in my room, but with the extremely high humidity, sometimes it doesn't help. The only time I am free from the heat is when I am in the dining halls or at my internship. Hope, as someone who went to college in Miami and did some summer classes, I can totally feel your pain. Jessica writes, I'm from Louisville, Kentucky, and suffer from multiple sclerosis, a disease exacerbated by the heat. I'm also a stay-at-home mom with 2 kids under 6. We feel trapped inside during the summer, and it's awful. We've also had to forego vacationing in Florida in the summer months in recent years because it's dangerous for me. Dr. Benjamin, to Jessica, and she said that MS exacerbates her condition. I wonder also, as a mom, are there certain things that parents with children should be looking out for that are different from what we look out for with adults, or is it just kind of the same set of risk factors?
Well, those risk factors are there, but remember that kids, particularly the really little kids, can't get to the water themselves. And so making sure your children are adequately hydrated is very important. And I cannot can overemphasize this. Don't leave kids or pets in hot cars.
Yeah.
And just want to cannot overemphasize that enough. By the way, also other places, even your home, when it's very hot. You obviously won't normally leave them alone, but you just need to be very, very careful.
That greenhouse effect inside the car or the house like kicks in very quickly.
Absolutely. Typically, you don't have air conditioning.
By the way, speaking of hydration, if somebody is dehydrated and they're like, oh, I need something cool, should they go for just water, plain old water, or a sports drink like Gatorade? Like, what's the difference, and is there really a difference in the value to the average person?
Yeah, for the average person, you know, water is great. It works real hard. It works well. But, you know, if you're out there and you're losing a lot of salt, you're exercising, and you're sweating a lot, those sports drinks are designed to give you a more balanced salt solution. The only caution I have is for those people who are very salt sensitive. You know, they have congestive heart failure or another medical condition where they have to limit their intake of salt. They should consult their physician. But for most of us, you know, plain water works just fine.
Unless you have like a cardiovascular condition and then talk to your doctor.
That's correct.
We have talked a lot about Arizona, particularly Phoenix, and how very hot it is there. Let's talk about what cities like Phoenix are doing to beat the heat. Joining our conversation now from KJZZ Public Radio in Tempe, Arizona, is David Handula, an assistant professor at Arizona State University's School of Geographic Sciences and Urban Planning. David, welcome to 1A.
Good day, Joshua. Thanks for having me. 115 ahead for us today here in Phoenix.
Dude, I'm unbuttoning my top button just to hear you say that. That makes no sense. Okay, look, I've never been to Phoenix. So you're just going to have to explain to me as a Floridian who is used to living near a gigantic body of water, how do Arizonans deal with that heat? Like, when you move to Phoenix, what's the one thing they always warn new Arizonans to do to not die in that heat?
Yeah, there are so many different interesting strategies that people use here in the Phoenix area to beat the heat. Heat is an everyday hazard that we deal with almost every hour of the day. If you could imagine what folks who live in cold climates deal with in the winter in terms of being careful about where they place their feet to avoid slipping on the ice or putting gloves on to avoid touching a cold surface, we have almost the exact same situation here in the summer months. It's not unusual to hear from some of our neighbors that they literally put gloves on when they get in their car to avoid touching the hot steering wheel or the hot seatbelt buckle. And you can imagine small strategies like that are in place day in, day out for the nearly 4 million people who live in the metro area here.
You mean gloves like those Nomex, like the of glove, basically?
Yeah, the of glove, or really anything you can get your hands on, a towel, an extra T-shirt you might have in the car, an old rag, anything to protect from that hot surface.
Now, you've been working with the city of Phoenix on heat mitigation. Give me an example of some of the things that the city is doing to try to give people a reprieve from the heat or just to make the heat more bearable. What seems to be working?
Certainly. Because Phoenix has been a hot place for a very long time, the city of Phoenix itself and the other municipalities have been quite proactive in trying to cool the cities, but also provide options for people to get out of harm's way. The city of Phoenix itself has an aggressive Tree and Shade Master Plan that calls for increasing the tree canopy cover in the city up to 25% by 2030. And this parallels some other greening initiatives in place in other cities like New York City or Los Angeles, for example. The city on its publicly owned owned buildings has also been painting roofs white, and the idea there is to reflect some of the incoming sunlight away from the city to avoid trapping that heat near where people are during the daytime hours. And there are many other strategies that are in place to cool the cities. What's encouraging about these options, we talked a lot about global scale climate change in earlier segments, and what's really encouraging about these strategies is that they tackle the other half of warming that we're seeing in our cities that comes from urbanization, the way we design, build, and grow our cities. That urban growth also contributes a lot of warming, but we know that we can offset some of that warming, maybe even all of that warming, with the right design strategies and technologies.
Yeah, Dr. Benjamin mentioned earlier people who live in these places, these heat islands. I wonder how that heat island effect plays out somewhere like Arizona that's more flat, that's more spread out, as opposed to, say, New York, where you have Manhattan, which is literally a gigantic island of heat. How does that play out in Phoenix?
Many cities around the world, Phoenix and New York City included, have this characteristic urban heat island effect where the center of the city and the developed areas are warmer than the surrounding natural landscape. This is especially true at night here in Phoenix because we also have calm winds and the relatively flat topography you talked about. We really can see this characteristic pattern in satellite imagery and in meteorological observations where the city center might be 10 degrees Fahrenheit warmer at night than the surrounding desert landscape.
We're speaking to David Handula, an assistant professor at Arizona State's School of Geographic Sciences and Urban Planning. Also speaking to Dr. Martin Herling, research meteorologist at NOAA's Earth System Research Lab, and Dr. Georges Benjamin, executive director of the American Public Health Association. David, with regards to some of these strategies, I totally hear you on the white roofs. That's, for example, I remember when the American Airlines Arena in Miami, where the Miami Heat play, was built, they mentioned they painted the whole roof white because it helps to reflect the heat away and keeps the building cooler. But in terms of the tree canopy, I wonder how that works in a place like Phoenix. It makes sense in a place like Florida, where we get tons of rainfall every year. But in a place like Arizona, where you have less rainfall, do you have to pick different trees, fewer trees? Are there certain kinds of options that will work in some places but not in a place like Phoenix?
Yeah, you're exactly right. Getting the right mix of trees in the landscape and other technologies that can provide shade, manufactured shade is an option as well. But getting that right mix of trees, choosing species that are desert adapted, ecologically appropriate, and also aesthetically tolerable, if not aesthetically appealing, is really important. And there's an ongoing conversation between the city arborist and other local organizations here that are trying to support these green initiatives to ensure that people are aware of what the right mix of trees is that is, you know, don't require too much water, don't emit compounds into the atmosphere that might exacerbate air quality problems, and otherwise don't pose nuisances or risks to people who live here in the city. It is a careful, delicate conversation that comes with some trade-offs that we need to be aware of, but we think we're getting our heads around it as a community, and we have some optimism that we can succeed in achieving this tree canopy goal.
David, I wonder if you could respond to a tweet from Gwen. Gwen writes, "It's important to note that unlike heat, there aren't laws that require landlords to provide air conditioning, even though heat is as deadly as cold. Also, even in many hot climates, affordable and mid-range housing and rental units don't commonly have central AC." What about the rules on air conditioning in Phoenix, David?
Yeah, this is something we really need to be thinking more about. There are certainly some rules in place that provide protections for tenants who might have their air conditioning go out in the summer or perhaps be operating inefficiently. But it's my opinion that the regulations that are on the books right now to protect people are simply not enough. The regulations call for written notice, for example, between tenants and landlords, the use of certified mail and some other options. These are slow options when it's a life or death matter that somebody's dwelling is too hot, when it's 90, 95, 100 degrees inside for someone. I don't think it's reasonable for us to be expecting written communication through the mail between them and a landlord to try to make repairs. We need stronger protections in place to ensure that people have access to emergency services and relief right away. And I'm hoping that some of our municipalities here can take some more aggressive steps, looking exactly as our tweeter said, about some of the places that deal with cold as a hazard, where the laws are very clear on the books about what can be happen, what can happen to protect people, and how quickly those services must be provided.
Skip is here in D.C. Skip emailed, "Painted a bright white waterproof coating on the sloping flat portions of my roof in D.C., and it makes a big difference, not just on the heat load, but on solar radiation that would otherwise penetrate into the house. Try it." Elliot emailed, "One of the things that's often not discussed is the effect these warmer temperatures have on rainfall patterns. In Washington, D.C., the first 17 days of July 2018 were the driest on record. However, since July 17th, D.C. has recorded so much rain, July 2018 is now the second wettest month of all time in the district." Dr. Herling, I don't want to dwell on this too much, but the link between heat waves and rainfall, is there really a link, or is it just the kind of thing that, like, Floridians like me think we notice when it's super hot?
Well, we do notice, so that's an affirmation of your caller's observation. The warming of the planet also means that the air as a whole holds more water vapor. So that when storm systems, whether they're thunderstorms or cyclones, hurricanes, or cold fronts come through an area where more water vapor is in the air, there's more rain that falls. Every station in the U.S. is monitored for rainfall. That goes back, many stations, I should say, on the order of 1,000 or more. It goes back over 100 years.
Stations, you mean weather stations?
Weather stations, okay. Exactly. And these weather stations are dispersed fairly uniformly across the country, and they paint a picture of an increase in the intensity of daily rainfall. So when rains occur, they tend to be more pouring rains.
Right, right.
And that is a symptom of a warming planet because of the additional water vapor that these higher temperatures allow the air to hold.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Geneva tweets, "I am a public librarian. We always see an uptick in patrons spending their whole day with us whenever there's a heat wave. We need more public spaces that are free and open to the public to get through these climate changes as a nation." Shannon tweets, "How much of our inability to cope with this heat is because we have trained our physiology by working and living exclusively indoors now?" Dr. Benjamin, what do you think?
Well, you know, there's some sense to that. You know, the fact that we're now sitting inside playing on our computers and our cell phones and our games mean that we don't go outside and acclimate. You know, and it takes almost a week for you to acclimate to the heat. So there's certainly a situational truth to that, absolutely.
Charlie wrote on our Facebook page, "Breaking news, it's hot in July." Dr. Herling, what about Charlie's comment? I understand what he's getting at. He's being a little snarky, but really, should we be this shocked about the nature of this heat? I mean, it's July. It's hot in July, right?
Yes, it has been hot in July for quite a few centuries, quite frankly, but it's never been this hot. And I think that's the point. The typical year-to-year variation of a July temperature may be 1 or 2 degrees, but now there's a trend that has been going on for over a half century that has added an additional 1 degree Celsius to that. It's becoming perceptibly hotter than experiences ever felt before. And it's also acquiring these sort of thresholds in which the comfort level is really becoming challenged, as we heard your other guest speakers address.
I do want to note that a number of you did talk to us about access to cool spaces or the lack thereof at times. Here's what Amanda left in our voicemail inbox.
And we could try to seek relief through swimming or water or whatever. All of those things we have to pay for. In some cases, the water is too dirty for people to be swimming in, but the relief is so hard to find that there's no other option. There was a lake warning here in Michigan about the water being too cold that it could shock the system because it's so hot outside. So the ways in which we get relief are limited.
I hear that, Amanda. Thanks very much for sharing your thoughts with us. All right, before we are out of time, let me get to a few more quick questions from each of you. Jason in Portland, Oregon asks, "What's the living situation?" And David, if you could answer this briefly. "What's the living situation like for people living on the street in the summer? Are there shelters for when it gets into the hundreds, sort of like how other cities have shelters for when temperatures drop too low?" David?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Good question there. We do have a network of cooling centers, we call them, here in the Phoenix metropolitan area. Several dozen facilities that thankfully volunteer to open their doors to folks seeking relief during the summer months. Of course, we could use more of those facilities, especially facilities that are open on the weekends and after business hours when it can remain dangerously hot. But we have seen these facilities in use when we visited them, evaluated them with our local public health department and others. The cooling centers that are in place here in our region, we believe, are making a difference, especially helping those people who are on the street in the summer months.
Dr. Herling, a quick question from Patrick, who tweeted, if humanity curbs greenhouse gases, how soon can we expect a noticeable change? Heat waves seem to only get worse, and current global temperatures took decades to rise to current levels. Is it too little, too late?
Well, you know, back to the 1990 IPCC report we mentioned, they indicated that at that time, it would take about a 60% reduction in the emissions of greenhouse gases to keep sort of the climate, if you will, stationary to what the conditions of 1990 were. In the subsequent 30 years, greenhouse gas emissions have actually risen by 50%. Not where we had hoped to go, quite the opposite direction. It pretty much scales with the growth in global population.
So
we
is
have
it
a challenge.
But, so is it too little, too late? I mean, is there anything that can be done?
Definitely, there are solutions. There are solutions that require policy. They require choices. This is not my expertise, so I won't dwell on that. But there are technologies, there are policies that can be implemented that can avert the worst consequences of ongoing warming.
And Dr. Benjamin, is the big takeaway from today, drink more water, check in on yourself when you're out in the heat?
Absolutely, and your family members.
Check on yourself, your family, and your neighbors, especially if you've got elderly neighbors.
That's absolutely right.
Dr. Georges Benjamin, Executive Director of the American Public Health Association. Dr. Benjamin, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
David Hondula, heat researcher at Arizona State University. Thanks, David.
Thank you. Stay cool out there.
And Dr. Martin Herling, research meteorologist from NOAA's Earth System Research Lab. Thanks, Dr. Herling.
My pleasure.
This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. Go drink some water. This is 1A.